Just as she was certain that the faceless swivel head would turn and see her, the tugging on her foot brought her back to reality. She opened her eyes and saw the doctor at the other end of her bed. He had pulled the covers off of her foot and was examining it.
"I can't see anything wrong with this foot," he sounded annoyed.
"You're looking at the wrong foot. What do you want, anyway? Corporal Boyd looked after it. I want to sleep." Heedless of her, he tucked in the good foot, for the room was chilly, and uncovered the injured limb.
"It's just after 4. You're not going to sleep late, are you?"
He nodded at sight of the swollen foot and pushed up the covers over her shin so that she couldn't see exactly what he was doing.
4? 4 in the morning?
She got up on her elbows. He turned on the light, but the window was still dark.
"Yes, 4 in the morning. It's high time you were up."
Then he jabbed something into the top of her foot. Before she could shout at him, he gave a quick turn to whatever he had inserted into the instep, and the pain radiated and then faded. He continued to work, and she felt several small stabs that were not bad at all. The radiating sensation went up into her shin, almost to her knee at one point, and then faded away. But when she tried to wiggle her toes, the pain was excruciating. She gasped and fell back.
"I didn't say to move anything. Just let the needles work. Keep the toes still. You humans and your toes."
She recovered from the unexpected bit of pain.
"You've got toes too, haven't you?"
"Yes, to help me with my balance. I don't wiggle them. There's no rational reason to wiggle toes, not anywhere in the universe."
"It's a human signal to tell people to slug off,"
and in spite of the pain, she wiggled her toes at him for a moment. This annoyance with the doctor was more to her liking. The awe had been getting in her way.
"Look, it will take 20 minutes for the acupuncture to make the swelling go down and the pain to fade a bit. You can doze all you like between now and then, but we need to get to TSRG as soon as the gates are open, and they open at 6.
"Why first thing?"
"Because they won't be prepared first thing, so whatever they're hiding will be easier to find."
She fell back onto the pillows and closed her eyes, careful to remember not to move her foot.
"What did you find yesterday on site? What incensed Dr. LeFranc enough to push a box onto your foot?"
"My call for an investigation incensed her," Liz said, eyes still closed. "I thought I was allowed to sleep until the needles came out."
"Oh, very well,"
and she heard him plump himself down into the lopsided easy chair. But Liz, though she closed her eyes, knew that she would not go back to sleep.
"What are those Daleks, Doctor? Are they robots?" she asked, eyes still closed.
He didn't answer. After a moment, she opened her eyes and looked at him. His eyes were pensive. His face seemed more lined and tired now.
"Well?"
"No, they're not robots, Liz. They come from a race remarkably like your own race, on a planet called Skaro. The Daleks are super-mutated creatures. Their natural bodies have been minimized to allow for an expanded brain that is capable of bonding to a self-containment unit."
"Bonding how?"
He shrugged.
"You're familiar with process logic controllers?"
"Yes, of course. Most factory automation uses controller systems."
"Yes, well, the Daleks actually have a simple access system to run their housing units. A few implanted logic circuits embedded directly into their sensory receptors can detect high and low signals that trigger responses in their robotic armor and the attached automation."
"So they're just armor-plated mobile people. Why are you so afraid of them?"
"They're not just armor-plated mobile people. They're far worse. They're powerful, and they're unpredictable."
"But so were the Cybermen, and you defeated them. And the Nestines were horrible. Horrible and terrifying, and we defeated them together."
"Liz,"
and once again she could hear the resignation in his voice.
"Cybermen want to extend the human race by whatever means they require, even if that involves killing off part of the species.
And Nestines want to extend their own race by whatever means they require. But Daleks want to destroy all other races unless they have a good reason to keep one or two races alive in order to be made into slaves. And the Daleks will keep improving themselves based on shrewd calculations."
He knit his eyebrows.
"How? Improve themselves how?"
"Well, they're already immune to just about any viral or bacterial agent that will kill a human. And they withstand changes in temperatures and changes in air pressure pretty well. And they can filter out most particulates from the air they take in, and it isn't much, by the way, so it's impossible to poison them. Most explosions have no effect on them."
He glanced around the room.
"Our natural environment can easily compromise our strengths, but the Daleks are pretty good in any environment. Any Earth environment, where cities have been built, anyway."
He let out his breath.
and they keep improving their casings and their ability to read their environments. If you brought up a bazooka against one of them, it'd shoot you down before you could fire off a round. And even if you did fire off a round, you might knock the Dalek back a few feet, but you wouldn't hurt it otherwise.
How would it hurt you?
One of its appendages is a gun that it can fire at will, a nasty piece of work that's been banned by the intergalactic community.
She sat up on her elbows.
An appendage that joins directly into its arm?
Well, in a manner of speaking, the fact is the Dalek arm is mechanical and joins directly into its biological matrix.
Boyd found something at TSRG. We thought it was some sort of killing device that would harm him, but now I think it's what you're describing, a connector that acts as an interface between something biological and something mechanical.
And she described the disc that had latched into Boyd's hand. The doctor knit his eyebrows in doubt as she finished her description.
I don't know. I mean, it does sound like a biomechanical interface, but the Daleks protect their technology with fanatical secrecy. I cannot imagine them handing over the cornerstone of their own construction interface system to human beings.
Perhaps it's a gambit, a trinket to throw at TSRG until these Daleks can get a foot in the door and then wipe out everybody, TSRG with the rest of humanity. Then they can take their technology back with no losses.
He sounded doubtful.
I've never heard of Daleks taking a risk with anything they actually valued. We'll see. I'll take a look at it once my equipment is transported up here.
What does their personal weaponry do? What's the action?
The Dalek gun fires a very dense energy signal in a type of slug or packet. The energy slug is so powerful and yet so contained that it immediately converts all matter that it touches to energy and then back again in about a thousandth of a second. Nothing is affected but the target. One blast is effective enough to distort your guts and make a fatal mess of your insides. The energy slug displaces everything it touches for that same fraction of a second, so there's no hope of recovering from a shot if it hits you anywhere on your torso.
A look of horror crossed her eyes. He looked at her sharply, but she asked, "So if they shot you in the gut?"
"If I were shot by a Dalek gun, it would blow my stomach, some rib material, and part of my digestive tract as raw energy into my kidneys and spine, and everything would rematerialize in a fusion of organ material, bone, and muscle.
Get these pins out of my foot, quick, and find me some tea or coffee while I change, will you? We've got to get moving. We've got to get to TSRG before they clean out that meat locker."
It was a sudden reverse to have Liz Shaw ordering the doctor about, but the Time Lord swiftly removed the sewing needles he had used for improvised acupuncture, and he left to find an abbreviated breakfast for her while she got into her borrowed clothes. One of the rare pleasant aspects of riding in the Doctor's vintage Edwardian roadster was that it negotiated the roughest terrain with hardly a disruption of the passengers inside the vehicle, so Liz could safely gulp down hot tea in an open, Army-issue billy can as the Doctor sped them towards the TSRG gates. The Doctor drove over the rough road like a man possessed, but the tea never sloshed.
"You may as well slow down," she called over the rushing air. "We'll have to wait for the unit team at the gates anyway."
The pre-dawn air was well below freezing, and she was thankful for the thermal undergarments she had donned, as well as the heavy unit parka and the gauntlet-type gloves. The tea was nearly scalding, just as she liked it. Unexpectedly obliging, the Doctor cut the speed.
"Tell me what you saw in greater detail. I mean those hog carcasses."
"It was nearly as you described. One of the animals had its foreleg, the bone, I mean, flattened almost to a sort of shield and splashed up into the flesh of the shoulder. I had thought at first that it was a genetic defect or perhaps the result of a biological agent."
"That sounds like the effects of a Dalek gun."
"But it wasn't exactly as you described. I mean, the scorching, for one thing. All of the slain animals were pretty well scorched around the wound sites, and some looked like they'd been hit by a flamethrower."
She hesitated, and he finished the thought for her.
"Just like some of the human victims, scorched very badly, with a visible burn to show entry of some type of slug of energy."
"But you said the Dalek weaponry leaves no mark."
"Well, there is such a thing as blossoming."
She turned to him, but he kept his eyes on the road. The light was rising. She could see him now, better than when they had started out. He was squinting into the wind as he drove, but she sensed that it was that same fear that urged him onward.
Whatever these Daleks were, he feared them with an almost unreasoning dread.
"Blossoming," she asked.
"Happens in laser dispersion, too. There's a slight error in the frequency, a displacement as the energy meets the surface of the target. The energy beam gets slightly out of phase with itself, and there's a range of frequency created that distorts the purity of the signal. So most of the energy beam goes into the target as designed, but a small percent blossoms out and is less effective. It penetrates to a shallow level and may only char the flesh, like a flame or electrical arc would do."
"A couple of the hogs had half their heads or parts of their limbs blown off, and all charred, too. But the stumps showed that same hard fusion of body tissues."
"Severe blossoming. Somebody hardly knows what they're about, and they've been using hogs for target practice to see how to adjust their signal on transmission." And suddenly he seemed more assured, as though a new thought had struck him, a realization that things might not be so bad.
"They've been using human beings, too."
"Yes, but we're on to them now, Liz."
"We need evidence."
"It's waiting for us there. I'm sure they've got plenty of prototypes stashed away, not to mention the hogs." She shook her head.
"I'm sure they've gotten those carcasses safely hidden or destroyed."
"Several tons of hog carcasses. I don't know where." But she threw her gaze out over the bleak, barren landscape and the rough grasses. "Anywhere," she thought. The guard station at the front perimeter gate was already occupied when they drove up to it and stopped, but neither of the uniformed men inside came out to inquire of them. Liz passed her tea to the doctor and shared it with him while they waited. Normally, she would have expected him to bluster and bully his way through the gate, but the gravity of the situation had prompted him to wait for unit. The very fact that he was cautious dismayed her. But he affected an air of leonine indolence and leaned back with a steaming billy can. He stared at the guard shack with indifferent interest. She folded her arms and experimentally wiggled her toes inside her shoes. His impromptu acupuncture had brought the foot almost back to normal. Their wait was brief. Within minutes, she heard the rumble of unit vehicles approaching from behind. The cold sky was brightening further, and the guard shack switched off its interior lamps as the day arrived. Frost lay over the tops of the grasses nearby. Coming up from behind the unit convoy of jeeps and the staff car, an army lorry recklessly passed the vehicles and hurtled towards them.
"Who the dickens is that?"
"Corporal Boyd." She took the tea from him and helped herself to a drink from it.
"He drives like a lunatic."
"He drives like you, Doctor," she made her voice lofty. Before he could think of a retort, the lorry skidded to a stop alongside them, and Corporal Boyd thrust his head from the driver's side window.
"A courier is on its way with information packets on the two scientists. Do you want to come with me, Professor Shaw? We can meet the carrier halfway and cut off an hour or two if you read the information while I drive."
"Yes, that's best." She glanced at the doctor. The rest of the vehicles pulled in and the soldiers exited. The guards in the guard shack stared out at them and spoke swiftly on their telephones. Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, a hint of a frown on his face, approached.
"What was that all about, Corporal?" he asked.
"In a hurry to get some information from a courier, sir. I thought I'd better ask Professor Shaw if she wants to come with me. Might save time."
Lethbridge Stewart glanced at her.
"Well, Miss Shaw?"
"Yes, if we meet the courier halfway, I can call ahead to you with any pertinent information."
The doctor became contrary.
"I need Liz here to show us around."
But Liz protested. "Doctor, if the hogs have not been hidden up until now, there's no hiding them in the interval between your walk from here to the kitchen." The brigadier made a decision.
"Yes, I think I'd like Miss Shaw out of here. We cannot afford to have her perceived as a part of a unit raid on this place."
"Well, draw us a map to the kitchen larder first."
A few minutes later, the doctor, the brigadier, several unit soldiers, two of the TSRG guards, and an indignant Dr. LeFranc walked down the dim basement hallway towards the meat locker.
"I hardly thought Professor Shaw was the type to be carried away by the sight of hog carcasses,"
LeFranc exclaimed in her terrible accent.
"I don't believe it either, madam. Therefore, I thought it most prudent to check her observations."
And the brigadier's voice was firm.
"I have no idea if the carcasses are still there or not. The kitchen staff is who you should talk to, and they won't be here until 10. You might have spared us all this early morning raid."
"I apologize for the inconvenience.
But if, as you claim, DSRG is just as subject to unexplained power disruptions as the village is, then the best plan was to come as soon as the gates were open. Surely you see that.
And for all we know, you unit people rig that power disruption.
Dr. Lefranc, if you know of any possible technology that could have done what happened last night, you'd better tell us right away. As far as we know, nothing on Earth could suppress power like that.
I know of no such thing.
And then she pursed her lips closed and led them to the shining steel door that Boyd had described. One of the TSRG men fished out a ring of keys, selected one, and turned it in the lock. He pulled open the large door, and the doctor and Brigadier both stood in the doorway and gazed at the interior.
Empty, of course.
Where are those carcasses?
You will have to ask the kitchen staff. I do not direct ancillary operations.
The Brigadier turned to his point man.
Get this entire place sealed off. Nobody in or out. Relay my orders to Captain Monroe to send the men on standby right away. If you have to, call in army reinforcements. They'll be willing to set up liaison with us.
For a moment, Lefranc's mouth opened in surprise, and the doctor, not normally given to noticing such details, was surprised at how blankly stupid she could look when taken by complete surprise. It was disarming, considering her station at TSRG. In an instant, he realized that she was not accustomed to being defied outright. But she quickly recovered. She spoke to one of her own men.
Get Major Redbird down here. Tell him the situation has gotten out of hand.
Where is Dr. Schepansky? The doctor asked sharply. We must see her.
But now the guarded look in Lefranc's eyes was impenetrable.
Dr. Schepansky has been fighting an illness. She became very sick last night and was moved off the site to regular medical facilities.
Where?
The Brigadier asked.
That is none of your business.
In spite of the frostiness of the air outside the warm cab of the lorry, the brilliant blue of the cloudless sky was invigorating. Liz watched it as Boyd drove. Fleetingly, she considered the irony of places as dark and secretive as TSRG, sitting right in the midst of such brilliant light and wild glory. It was in moments like these that she considered if there might not be some benevolent good that ruled everything outside of mankind itself. She had felt this more than once, and always in the presence of profound beauty in nature. You could take it all apart, she thought, decompile it all down into its chemical bonds, and still not comprehend what made it all look so fitly put together. Nor could you ever comprehend why it made you feel so invigorated just to drive through the brilliant, windy, sunlit silence.
You're very quiet this morning, Professor. You all right?
Oh, just taking it all in, the glory of everything.
He shot her an appreciative glance.
I never took you for a reader of children's fiction.
She was startled.
What?
And then he recited for her benefit.
The garrulous geese, the change in seasons, the heat of the sun, the passage of swallows, the nearness of rats, the sameness of sheep, the love of spiders, the smell of manure, and the glory of everything.
She looked at him blankly.
E.B. White, he told her. Charlotte's Web.
Not the same E.B. White who wrote The Elements of Style.
He nodded.
The very same.
He glanced out at the bowl of clear blue sky around them.
He had his days like these.
So, she thought, Boyd felt it too. This pressing, almost insistent glory that didn't seem to take into account things like TSRG.
Do you believe in God? She asked.
Of course I do. He shot a glance at her. Don't you?
Sometimes.
Times like these, she thought, casting her eyes to the perfect blue sky. She understood what made it blue, but what made it so perfect? She wasn't sure she could relegate the wonder and peace it generated in her as the mere preference of a mind conditioned to prefer blue sky to gray.
No matter how bad things get, there's something always ready to reclaim everything and start over, he said.
In spite of his power to instantly impose a blockade on TSRG, Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart was kept waiting for Major Redbird in one of the misnumbered conference rooms for nearly an hour. Even when Redbird, a florid, large man with a dark mustache, finally entered the room, he was seized by Lefranc. So the Brigadier and Doctor, who had declined chairs and stood on the opposite end of the room, were still made to wait.
"That man's no more a Major than I am," the Doctor grumbled. "Why is it the British always appropriate military titles for themselves?"
Let's not antagonize him right off, Doctor,
the Brigadier murmured.
Perhaps we can work a way around this standoff.
Not with a handful of dead villagers left unaccounted for.
We don't know.
Whatever happened, a cover-up is certainly in place. The Doctor forgot himself and let his voice get too loud. Lefranc, Redbird, and the two attending security guards all looked over at him. The four unit soldiers looked at their boots and pretended not to have heard. Redbird approached. He held out his hand.
Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, is it?
Yes, Major Big Bird. How do you do?
The Brigadier asked. Redbird's florid face grew a great deal redder, and the Doctor's eyes lit up at his ally's blunder, but the Time Lord kept silent. The Brigadier, not realizing that he had misspoken, shook Redbird's hand.
Let's get right down to business. We are tracing the hog carcasses that were stored in the basement meat locker yesterday.
Redbird recovered himself and instantly became bland, almost dismissive.
I don't know anything about that situation.
We rely on your cooperation to learn what happened.
I'm sorry, I don't know anything about it.
And Redbird seemed content to be perfectly oblivious.
Then you'd better find out, because nobody is leaving or entering this site until we trace those carcasses.
The large, florid man seemed taken back by the Brigadier's annoyance.
I just don't see how I can get to the root of the matter any more than you can, Brigadier.
Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart put on his hat.
Very well, Major. I shall leave you to consider the matter. Perhaps after a few days you will find a way to get to the root of the matter. It's nothing to me if you sit here all winter.
Lefranc spoke up in her imitation accent.
You cannot imprison us in this facility.
You watch me, madam.
And the Brigadier strode out. The Doctor, for once impressed into admiring silence, followed him, and then the unit men. By noon, Liz and Corporal Boyd had met the courier and picked up the cardboard cases of information. As Boyd drove over the quiet road, Liz leafed through the first wad of papers. Shapansky went from a graduate program at Cambridge to work as a documentation clerk for an engineering firm.
Well, that sounds about right, Boyd observed.
It's not clear that she was particularly efficient. She leafed through more papers. The clearance done on her was thorough. There is a notation that she was on a probationary list when she left the firm.
And went to...
Back to Cambridge. Liz studied the work history more carefully. Probably got a post through a social connection.
Oh, yeah? How social?
Get your mind out of the gutter, Corporal. She was hired by the soul of conventional morality, Professor Rachel Jensen. An upright twig if there ever was one.
You know Jensen?
Only from reading her papers. She served as scientific advisor to the British military through the 1960s. She wrote a slew of materials on field assessments of emergency conditions. Very useful for my work with UNIT. He was impressed.
A woman professor in the 60s? Well, must be pretty bright.
Practical as well, very... The lorry swerved suddenly as she heard a clack that she couldn't identify. Boyd! But the corporal was slumped over the wheel. The lorry careened across the road the wrong way.
Corporal!
She seized the wheel and the paper spilled across the front seat and onto the floor, but she saw the widening pool of blood from him that spread across the floorboards and onto the pristine white sheets of the reports. He'd had the presence of mind to hit the brake in the moment left to him after he'd been shot. Liz tried to get her own foot into place on his side, but she could only slow the lorry as it left the road and trundled towards a line of trees. She worked the steering wheel to avoid hitting anything too solid. Tall grasses and narrow saplings brushed the underside of the lorry but failed to bring it to a stop. Then she saw, emerging from the brush and trees and even up from the waving grasses, a line of men, some with rifles. One of them pointed his gun at the lorry again. Liz threw herself down onto the seat. This bullet shattered the windscreen of the lorry. As glass sprayed over her and the body of the dead corporal, Liz realized that if the impending crash didn't kill her, she would be in the hands of the same people who had been stalking her for the last 2 days. She struggled to get hold of the wheel and find the brake with her foot, but Boyd's body was in the way. He was clearly dead, shot through the heart by a bullet that had pierced the windscreen and found its mark. She heard a great crash and was thrown into the dash. Her head hit the glove box and she fell to the floor of the lorry, unconscious.